Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining me this week on Tia Time. We'll get to the show in just a moment. First, I wanted to say thank you to all of you who have posted a rating on Apple Podcast. Apple Podcast is an app that can be downloaded to your phone or computer. The algorithm it uses allows more artists and art enthusiasts like yourselves to hear about the show. So if you haven't posted a rating yet, do it now. Thank you. On with the show. Welcome to Tia Time with Artists, the weekly podcast where we discuss the methods, challenges, and real-life experiences of living our creative dreams. What kind of creative warrior are you? Musician, filmmaker, painter, choreographer, poet, sculptor, fashionista? Let's talk about it right now. I'm your host, Tia Imani Hanna. This week on Tia Time with Artists, I have producer, creative artist, filmmaker, Gordon Skinner. Thank you so much, Gordon, for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's like, I'm excited to talk to you.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's so good to see you.
It's been a month of Sundays.
Yes, it has. Years of Sundays. This is true. I lived in New York for 11 years and knew Gordon in some of that time, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him since. So I'm so glad to see you.
More of a reason to start a podcast.
Yeah, it's one of those reasons to get out and reach all these people that I've known, all these artists that I've known, the warriors out there making it happen. And as we all learned through COVID, we need the artist to make the world a better place, to make it safe for all of us. And we've been doing it even without pay in some instances, just because that's what we do. I'm just trying to spread the joy and the appreciation to the artists that I know. So thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you.
Tell us about it. What got you started in filmmaking?
Ooh, interesting. I've always been involved in film and television, and certainly was weaned in theater. So that has always been an aspect, a staple in my life, or a structural element in my life. And I would say that I'd done some work in the mid, late 90s, where I was actually had shifted from being in theater and being in film. I was producing commercial theater, and I had two agents, a manager, an accountant, an attorney, and everybody was happy because everyone was getting paid. And then I made a shift. I had a great opportunity to interact with a group of severely physically challenged young people. We're doing presenting a play. We're doing the Odyssey. And I remember I was doing Odysseus to these very seriously challenged children. And once I, you know, had that encounter, and was an interactive production. So we were touching them and handing, when I say them, just our audiences, we would do our water purifications and rituals on stage in front of them and have them holding the purification bowls and all of that stuff. And we go into the school out in Long Island to do this same performance, but for this group of young people who were either in stretchers or in walkers or had missing limbs. And they were from the ages of 5 to around 10 or 11 years old. And my fellow cast members gave distance at that particular performance. And I, you know, was shocked by their reaction and even went further to more connect with these young people. And I recall I put my hand on the shoulder of this one young girl who didn't have arms. And she started rubbing my hand with her cheek. We were told that the performance would not go past 10 minutes maximum. And our performance was an hour and a half. Hmm. And it went the duration. And at the end, these young people, they started making these guttural noises and sounds, which at first was off-putting. And I was going, well, what is that about? And then I observed that they were actually crying and that their tears were tears of joy and celebration. And at that point, at that moment, I made a decision that my life was going to be about celebrating the beauty and the starkness of our lives, to celebrate and give honor to individuals who are voiceless and challenged. And because we're all walking wounded with scars seen and unseen, but these young people and people who are facing these particular types of challenges have more courage than soldiers standing up in a firefight, because they face their challenges each day and also determine that those challenges are not going to determine or dictate how they interact with others. And so that was the shift. And then I went from performing in those types of environments to working and doing international dispute mediation and conflict resolution and crisis intervention, working in the Balkans and in the Middle East, and was stationed in Greece for about 6 months and returned to the U.S. and was doing a lot of DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So the New Jersey State Police had a consent decree resulting from their racial profiling cases. Mm-hmm. And I was going in, working with all of the different state police throughout New Jersey and their police barracks, as well as to the cadets. And then that was right up till 2000, up until 9/11, 9/10. As a matter of fact, I opened an office two blocks away from the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, literally the day before. And could not get into my office. I lived six blocks away. I couldn't get into my apartment, even though I was working down there. Sure. So my friends encouraged me to actually start making films and making the documentaries that I had and the stories that I had. And I'd worked for Sony as a line producer and AD back in the early 90s when I finished grad school. So it wasn't foreign. I just had not put on the hat of being a director. Okay. And then started making my documentaries.
So when you put on the hat of being a director, because you came from the performance place first, and was that a huge leap for you to say, okay, now I'm going to be the guy that says, this is my vision and you're going to do this now? Or because it's a big switch in how you have to look at the picture of everything, isn't it? Or not for you?
I will say for me personally, it wasn't so big of a vision, so big of a jump, because I had AD'd and line produced. And oftentimes as an AD, I would be called in on a Saturday afternoon to first assistant director and line producer, which is a person who handles all the budget and the accounting and everything like that.
Okay.
So I was working for Sony Music, and we wound up doing a program, Sessions at 54th Street, that had Tori Amos and David Byrne as the host. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I'd be called in when I was doing all these crazy music videos for them to be told that they had fired the director and that I had to bring the job in. So it wasn't that I didn't feel capable of directing, but the challenge was that there is a shift, and it's a subtle shift. The moment that it's your film, all the things that you know as an AD, as an assistant director, and certainly everything that I know as a producer, all of that stuff goes out of the window, you know? Mm-hmm. And then you're talking through Jello and you're going, blah, blah, blah. I'm going, yeah, but I know I've dealt with these situations before. Right. And they came so fast and furious. My first film, the first day of shooting, we were supposed to have two cameras and one sound operator. And we wound up having five cameras and two sound operators that showed up. It was a blizzard. Oh. And yeah, and above. And so the people who were in the film were sitting in a semicircle and the cameras were outside of them. And the boom operators, the sound people were with boom poles, you know, holding over. And they started sword fighting with their boom poles above the talent.
Oh, my gosh. It's crazy. Yeah.
Exactly. So all the things that you know, mm-hmm. I think I have this phrase, which is true technique is knowing what to do when it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So all of our preparations lead us to this moment. So then when that type of crazy situation happens, what do? You actually pause, you bring the boom operators in the back and say, what are you doing?
Exactly.
What are you doing? You know? Get it together. And then you bring them back and those types of things.
So yeah. Trial by fire, for sure.
Baptism by fire.
Okay. So what was that first film? What was the name of that film?
That first film was called Sitting in the Fire, Profiles of the Peacemakers. And it looked at the role of the mediator, but also saying that we all have the capacity to intervene in the midst of disputes and arguments. By a quick example, I remember I just come back from the Middle East and I was on a subway, you know, in New York subway at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And this white guy is not observant and he bumps into, you know, this Hispanic guy. And the Hispanic guy was like, yo, you bumped into me. He's like, no, I didn't. And he's like, yes, you did. And I see it's escalating. So I immediately said, to the Hispanic guy, I said, excuse me, brother, I'm so sorry. I actually bumped into him and that's why he bumped into you. And the Hispanic guy goes, yeah, okay, brother, it's all right. So it's good. The white guy turns and goes, you didn't bump into me. I'm like, yo, shut up. And situations like that said, okay, it's not about pulling off a shirt and having a cape on and I'm super mediator. I'm going to stop bullets and all that nonsense. But do know it, but recognizing that, and this is a phrase that you'll appreciate, that we are interconnected with our environment. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. as such, am I going to be a passive observant when something is happening? Or am I going to the best of my ability, try to change the narrative and create value out of this situation? And so that was the intent for that particular project. You'd also understand that the intent of that film initially was to be a 20-minute short documentary. 20 mm-hmm. minutes, quick and painless, down and dirty, get out, get in, get out. Of course, it turned into a 6-part. You know, and I remember it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 hours of footage. You know, it's crazy.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That's just impressive in and of itself that you were able to do that out of a 20-minute thing and just find more and more. And so there's a vision there. You know, you've got right. this breadth of vision that a lot of people don't have. So that's very cool. That's very cool. So now, when you're looking for projects now, I mean, do you go out and find the projects yourself, or do you try to get someone to hire you to do them, or how does that work?
There's, you know, so my company is Reframe Media LLC. And one aspect of the company is that we are an MWBE certified vendor. The acronym stands for Minority and Women Business Entrepreneurs. And as such, we're a vendor. So for the city of New York, oftentimes that will mean that the city will put out an RFP, you know, request for proposals or plans for projects. My company, we actually go into the city and will then say to them, to the different agencies, this is what we're observing. And we feel that we can create the media content that will address these different issues of employee retention, workplace disputes, or transparency between the city and the residents, the inhabitants, the constituents. So that's one aspect. The other is as a production studio or production house, we will come up with projects. Now, we have two films that are in production. We have another that's in development. The one that's in development is a biopic of a very legendary and historic woman. I can't say more beyond that, but that's something that I was brought. And so people will approach me with projects, and depending on where they are and what we're up to, and if that's something that I can really help facilitate and add vision to, then we'll take it on. There are times where we may just come in as a producer, and there are times where I will produce and direct it.
Your company, is that, how many people are you employing?
As most businesses, our favorite number is 1099. Independent yeah. contractor.
Okay.
I love that. But it depends. There are a lot of creatives. And I think that something you alluded to before, where you said, you know, as a director, you're coming in and you're saying you're going to do this and you're going to do that. There are those who do that. That's not my approach. And there are also those who will wait for funding before they start a particular project. Again, that's not my approach, largely because the projects we're doing, not only are they topical, but they do have an impact on individuals' health and wellness. And so we will go ahead and start making it on our own dime. But going back to my point about not being a dilettante or this tyrant, I really believe that it's about collaboration. And while I can put on all the hats and I can give myself all of the different credits of producer, director, writer, that's not the process. And that's not, you know, that doesn't create the type of value, and it's not sustainable. I want people to come and bring their own artistry and to recognize that the films that we make, one, the films are messengers. We don't get this twisted. We're not the, it's not the message, but it is about how do we move audiences past somnolent innocence to become proactive and to become sustained change makers, recognizing that they, we can actually be the change that we are seeking.
Okay. So everything that you do is primarily non-fiction, you know, documentary.
That's what it's been. We I have two narrative shorts, actually three, that we're trying to put together as two different triptychs. And there are some narrative features that we're in the process of developing. So we will be moving into that arena as well. Yeah. So it's about storytelling.
Okay. And then like when you're looking for your collaborators to work with, are these people that you've just worked with on other sets or film school friends, or how does that, because I know in film, it's a lot about, oh, you worked out with me on this film and then you pull them over if they're available, or how do you get your team? How do you get the right team for your shoots?
First off, I didn't go to film school. I didn't study film in college, but I've learned on the job in the workplace. And I've been so incredibly fortunate and blessed. My first two films had titans in the industry. I had Sam Pollard as executive producer on my first two projects. And I continue to call upon him and see him as a mentor. And I'm trying, and he's agreed to come on this latest project that we're doing. So I'm very excited about that. Also, I had Albert Maysles, the legendary father of direct cinema or cinema verite in this country. He came on as DP or director of photography and an executive producer. And I'm a pretty good judge of character and where an individual is at. And there are people who've come to me and said, oh, this is a great story. It's a great film. You know, we're going to be able to do all these wonderful things. And I can see how this is going to, you know, be great for my reel and all this. And my response is, that's lovely. This ain't the project. This ain't gold, because it's not about you. And the moment that you get this shit twisted that it's about you, then that's cool. You need to have that conversation somewhere over there, because that's not the conversation that I'm in. So it is a number. I've met so many people and I've been blessed with so many people I've been able to collaborate with. I can say that, as mentioning Sam and Albert, you know, that brings a level of gravitas that afforded me a lot of access to people. And then just being on sets, as I said, my work in Sony, which I started working in Sony, I want to say in 91 to 96. Mm-hmm. And Maurice Alberti, who is this legendary woman cinematographer, I'm working there as a line producer and AD. I'm getting calls for jobs that she referred me to. And I didn't even get to thank her until 3 years ago, because I could never catch up to her. And Rachel Morrison, who was the first woman to be nominated for an Academy Award as a cinematographer, who shot Fruitvale Station, I want to say Mudville, but it's not Mudville. I always forget the title wrong. And she also shot Panther.
Oh, wow.
And she was at NYU Film School and came in, and she was one of the DPs for my first film. Okay. These walks, they continue to come. And when I'm looking for musicians, I'm going, who do I know in Detroit?
That's great. I'm available.
They present.
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's awesome. It's good to hear how these projects come into, I don't know, what's the word, fruition? Because it's the same thing with music projects. Is who do I want in this band this time? How are we going to make this particular tune work? How are we going to get this? I don't have producers. I always end up producing my own stuff because it's a little bit different in music. But unless you're in the pop world, then people say, oh, you need a producer.
It's different.
Yeah. It's just, that's a whole different thing. But for everybody else, I produce my own stuff because nobody else is going to produce me. And then trying to get that team together. So I have a great admiration for filmmakers because they seem to have that collaboration thing down. It's just part of the business. Yeah. It's a different thing because even musicians there's a lot more diva mentality in the musician world.
True. Sorry to interject, but I will humbly submit to you that I know a lot of musicians, and I've made a few music projects. And the musicians that I know of have, because of circumstance, because of the industry, and being able to learn from the likes of Family Stan and Sandra St. Victor, and saying, we're not going to be categorized. When you ask a musician, hey man, what kind of music do you play? And they go, what? Oh man, I just play music, partner. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, and I'm going to shout out like Martha Redbone and Aaron Whitby. They called it upon themselves where they started bringing in all of their friends and colleagues who are musicians and saying, listen, I'm doing this project. I want you to work on this project with me and I'll be available for you. And that's how they just started collaborating and empowering themselves to change that narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the important roles that artists can, should, and need to take now and moving forward.
Agreed. It's one of those things too, that is tricky still to find the people who are willing to do that.
True.
And that is, and I've met some, and that's great. And I'm excited about that. I've got a project that I'm working on with a puppeteer, which I would never have thought of. But we just happened to meet each other I think we were trying to get a job at a library or something, and they had auditions and we met each other there, and we're like, oh, and we tried to get something started, and then life happened for both of us. COVID happened, all kinds of things happened. And then we just caught up the other day. So we're going to work on a project. So I'm like, that's great. So it's just another avenue that I just never have thought of before. So I'm really hopeful that more of those kind of opportunities and more collective kind of collaborations will happen.
Create them.
Exactly.
Create them, you know.
Yeah, that's why I'm reaching out to people like you, because it's like, that's the podcast has been that. It's like catching up with all these folks that are doing amazing things.
The beauty is that as a musician, and music is that element, that art form that above all of the others is able to transcend all of our differences, all of our self-imposed silos, because music affects us on a visceral and emotional level that transcends language, orientation, religion, nationality. All of those things are out the window. Either you like it and it strikes chords on your heart, or you don't. And then there's the piece that does. And that piece that does will then inform your day, will inform your month, week, life, what have you, and you will share it with other people, and that'll create commonality. And so that's why music is crucial. I always look at music as a structural element. The moment that I think of a project of a film, I immediately go, how can I tell this story sans any language, just with music? And by example, if I were to make a horror film, You'll never see a horror film of mine. One, I'm not going to be making horror films, but you never see da-da-da-da, uh-oh, something bad is going to happen. Right. I actually go the complete opposite, play like harps and lovely music, and all of a sudden their head's chopped off. But right. I think it's important, again, because it how it's able to affect and inform your life. And that's a gift that you have as a musician, Tia, and that a lot of people don't have. So kudos to you, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Is there a project that you've been trying to get made for a long period of time, or it's just that you've just not gotten the right combination of people, or it's just not the right time to do that project? Is there something like that hangs over your head at all?
I'll put it this way. It's not that it's hanging over. That's one of the reasons why I'm late. And again, apologies, is that, so I've been making, as I mentioned, I have two films that are in production. And the one that I'm going to mention right now is called Blood Money, Patients for Sale. And it looks at the unjust enrichment by for-profit dialysis providers at the expense of the patient and the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And so that film is challenging, not only because of what it purports to say about how incentivize medicine at the expense of not only the Hippocratic Oath, but at the patient of our humanity. How is it that a nephrologist can be more beholden to a corporation as to how they will provide healthcare to one who is so much at a loss of their own facilities? What does it say about a society where, let me rephrase that. It speaks volumes about a society when you look at how those who are in most need are treated. And so I've been working on this film. I started in 2010. We took a hiatus in 2018 because I wound up having 24 whistleblowers. And I was having to figure out, how do we release the film and still protect the anonymity of the whistleblowers? Mm. And there's so many. I'll give you a quick snapshot. Think of an iceberg and what's above the water. Okay. Right. Okay, so here's an above the water aspect of the film. Between 2002 and 2012, 100,000 African Americans were killed by the overuse of a drug that was known that it would lead to cramping, stroking, cardiac arrest, and death. With a 5-year investigative study by ProPublica, numerous New York Times articles that all attested this, and it was with the knowledge of CMS, the FDA, and complicit were DaVita and DCI, with Fresenius also as the manufacturer, for 10 years. And it was pulled from the shelf in 2012, relabeled, and put back out. There was a mass tort trial in which less than 5% of that 100,000 number, less than 5% of their families were aware that their loved ones died because of this drug. Less than 5% of that number participated in the mass tort. When Fresenius realized that they were going to lose, they entered into a settlement agreement. At the same time, were going about getting an appeal. They got the appeal, won on the appeal, which meant that nobody got nothing. Now, understand, when I say this, think about the Tuskegee, experiment. Mm-hmm. That we think about that as historic because that was 30 years and it happened in 1940 to 1972. This happened in this century. It happened during, obviously, before the Obama administration came in, but during his watch. What does that say? And how is it that these things have happened and continue to happen? Because of that type of story, and even though the film isn't about big pharma, it's really about the dialysis or the renal industrial complex, as I refer to it, that's a threat to broadcasters. And being that it's a threat to broadcasters, then it becomes challenging for funding. I actually don't go for funding. I actually go for, impact investment. But knowing, where is this going to air? What are the broadcasters that would actually take on this subject? So that's something, it's not ahead of its time. It's just trying to create the right platform in which to get this project out.
Yes. Wow. That's terrible.
Real nice Procter & Gamble feel-good films.
Yeah. You got to change the world somehow, right? Yeah, but the hardest part is, how do you get that out to the public? How do they even hear about it or see it?
We have various cuts of it while I'm continuing to film. And so we will share that. I don't make it publicly available. I will have to know because the pharmaceutical industry and other nefarious entities were trying to figure out so that they could then go and prepare them, protect themselves, decided, okay, we'll password protect this. We will, share it and reveal it to specific audiences and share it with individuals and church groups and continue to do non-theatrical screenings of it. And again, this is not anything new to me. My second film called Strategic Omissions, The Truth Behind the Health Effects After 9/11, which we started screening in 2004, was addressing the fact that people were sick and dying and more would become. So again, we take on these Herculean projects, if you will, not because we're trying to be grandiose, but because there is a need. And again, I am the change that I seek. And I hope to give license to others to be the change that they seek as well.
Yeah, how do you even cut a film that you've been working on for more than 10 years, for 20 years?
Fortunately, I haven't been working on one for 20 years. There are a couple that I've started a long time ago and then we paused footage. That's, again, it comes down, that's why collaboration is, because, you know, otherwise it becomes the world according to me, and it's, and that's not a world or a universe I want to be a part of. I'll never be a member of any organization that would have me as a member. But I think that that's why identifying those editors or people that you have respect for, also those that you could learn something for and learn something from, doesn't mean someone who is older than you or someone who's been doing this longer, but somebody who has another vision that you can respect and appreciate. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the collaborative process is so crucial, for at least for me. I really believe strongly that you know, connect with people who can help bring projects to fruition, take them to another level, and add something else to it, something that we might not have heard or thought of.
When you do work, when you find an editor, do you have one or two that you tend to work with on a regular basis, or do you just pick them per project?
It depends, because editors, like grant writers, if they're good, they're just always working. And then you're trying to either hold and wait in the queue for them. This phenomenal editor and just an amazing human being who we lost very sadly last year, Louis Erskine. Louis, pantheon. If you look over the work that he's done, and then he went on to go in-house and become an adjunct at NYU. Louis had done, he was doing Stanley Nelson's film on, and now the title is escaping me, but Jonestown. And I'm forgetting the exact, he was doing that. And I was doing a film on child soldiers. And I go to Louis, and he's, Gordon, we want to work together. We got to work together. He said, however, I've just been doing a film about Jonestown, man. I gotta get away from this. You know, child soldiers, it's going too much. And I said, okay, I respect that. And then this guy, Tim Hetherington, who also passed away a number of years ago now, amazing photojournalist. We would be seeing each other out in the field, whether it was in Sri Lanka or in Rwanda or elsewhere on the continent. And we always wanted to work together, but we were trying to, it wasn't that we were looking for the vehicle. We were just trying to carve out the space and the time to be able to work together. So I don't work with the same people, not because we haven't had a good experience or anything like that. It's just the availability. If they're really good, they're just always working, and you're trying to put the right vehicle before them and make sure that, from my perspective, that the vehicle or the project, if you will, is the right project for them.
Now, when you're working on editing, do you just give them a little, like a pathway to follow and then just let them have at it? Or do you sit there with them and say, no, I want this scene cut to this scene? Or how do you do it?
I'm not a big fan of micromanaging. And I do believe that it is important to give an artist latitude. You give them certain parameters by which to operate. You say, okay, we're doing, this is the film, this is the project, this is the purpose. It can't be completely out of left field, but for them to then share with you, this is how I see it. And then if you concur, and it's really about communication. I've definitely had people that were brought to me that telling me how they had Pulitzer Prizes and all this, and that I was just fortunate to have them working on my film. And then I informed them, you got a Pulitzer and I fired you. What is that?
Yeah.
You know? So don't try to flex. I'm academically well-educated and I'm cool and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm also from around the way. So don't try to like flex, because that's not going to work. But it's really about communication to you. It's really about, do you share a vision? And do you both have the same goals and objectives for the story? Again, as I said, for me, it's to move audiences from being voyeuristic to actually going, I have the capacity to bring about or raise awareness to this issue. This is an issue that affects me and my community or people that I know or people that I care about. And I'm going to be a champion for it. I'm going to be an ambassador. And once we understand that that is the objective, the editor then understanding that they can only make with that which I give them. So then it's beholden upon me to give them the best material I can. And then for them to be able to work their magic and their artistry and take it to another level.
Now, whole nother line of questioning. Okay, so if you were starting out today, because you didn't go to film school, you learned on the way, and now you've got people making digital films on their iPhones. What kinds of things would you do, or have you adopted to any of these new methods of making film? Like if you were starting today.
If I was starting today, mm-hmm. like I can't, I will not bash technology. I do think that it is about film economy, because now we can, it's not like back in the day where you either had a mini DV tape that was only 60 minutes. And for me, there's the challenge of self-financing a project, mm-hmm. you know, but then there's the beauty of it. The beauty is that I'm able to say to someone, I know where every dime has gone. Mm-hmm. I know that this tape cost me $3.50 and I have five of them, you know, and so we're not going to be fooling around just shooting the sky. And because we now don't have to worry about, you know, that, and you can only focus on going, oh, how big is your hard drive? Oh, it's a terabyte. Okay. We're shooting on HD or we're shooting on 4K. We're shooting on 4K. We may only have 10 minutes. We're shooting on HD. We have 10 hours.
Right.
That it becomes now, what am I shooting? What is the purpose? What is superfluous and what is going to yield the highest return? So I think that for me, were I starting, or as I, you know, continue to work with young people and old, you know, people who are deciding to explore their own artistry, I'm always talking to them about, okay, how do you get the maximum yield without just shooting forever? And I've been guilty of it. I was doing this music project for Cornelia Street Cafe, of all places, you okay. know, Robin Hirsch, God bless his soul. He commissioned me to make a doc about the cafe. I have 500 hours of footage. But again, it was over like 8 years. Okay. And it's all great stuff. Not because I shot it, but because fortunately people have seen it. But now how is that going to be? Is that going to be a series? No, the intent is for it to be theoretically an hour broadcast. So that then goes back to the editing. And so going to answer your question again, I would then say, okay, I don't have to shoot every song of the set. I can shoot this. And if I'm going to shoot the entire set, I'm going to change my camera angles. So I have cutaways, just appreciating the medium and what you have before you.
I've always been interested in making film, but it's such a whole different art form and such a commitment to the skill of learning the dialogue and learning the language of that in order to speak it fluently in order to make a film. And I've spent so much more time trying to learn my instrument that way. Right. So it's, I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to do that just because it's so to get to that point where it's fluid.
Got it.
Yeah, because I would think you'd have to take that sets of musicians that you filmed, and then you'd have to edit all of that down to what? Less than 5 minutes of stuff that you're going to put in different sections of the movie. You know, like, and you might be 50 hours of that, but you have to edit all of that out and then just, I can't even imagine.
And I edit by default. Even the fact that I shoot, a lot of these different skill sets that I have, I acquired so that I could have a better conversation with those who are much better at it. Mm-hmm. So I decided, okay, I want to be able to have a conversation with the cinematographer, my DP, director of photography, and be able to convey to them exactly what I'm looking to obtain. And a brief story, I remember it was the first film, and I decided with the first film, because I wanted to instill hope, every cut would go, instead of fading to black, it would fade to white. And so I told this really gifted producer, editor, director, Canadian woman who was here for many years before she returned, Rita Romanino, shouting out today. I told her what I wanted to do, and she said, Gordon, no, it'll never work. It's going to be the worst thing. You can't do this. I said, listen, please trust me. Just do it. If it works, they're going to give you the credit as the editor. If it doesn't, then they're going to slam me as the director. And she's like, okay. So she does it. And she calls me, Gordon, it worked. It's great. And I'm like, yeah. And so It wasn't because, again, I'm a gifted editor or I'm this great visionary of the great ideas, but it was saying to the editor in a conversation, this is the intent. If I can do it and I'm not an editor, I know you can do it far better because you are. And similar right. with the director and similar with the cinematographer and any department head, whether it's a grip or a gaffer, a PA, I'm always going to have that conversation about this is an art form, A. B, we are very fortunate that we have the ability to work in this medium. So now what are we doing with it? How are we utilizing it? How are we helping change the lives of individuals that we're working with? How are we looking to change the lives of people who are coming to watch this? Remember that in the height of the Depression, people would take their last 5 cents, and instead of going to buy a loaf of bread, they would go and sit in a movie, whether it's Charlie Chaplin or Michelle, somebody else, but someone going to see another filmmaker. Why? Because they knew that while that loaf of bread might sustain them for a certain period of time, but they would still be miserable. You know, they would go into that film and they would be hungry, but they would be happier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 'cause you have to feed the mind and the soul just as much as you have to feed the body. So that is a real thing. That is for sure a real thing.
And something that you alluded to earlier, and I have these two fellowships. One was with Encore and the New York Times op-ed as something called the Public Voices Fellow, which I had up until last year. And now I'm an alum and doing more things with them. And I'm also currently a Citizens University Fellow. But within those conversations, within those environments, I always hearken to share this, which I think is a credo for me, that the artist has always been the truest barometer of the human condition. And as such, art changes an individual. Individuals change societies, which makes all art political. And so it's so important. The artist is absolutely of paramount importance at this day and age. And it is equally of paramount importance that we help individuals tap into their artistry, whether it's garbage collecting or finger painting, whatever it is, whatever makes their life worth living and brings joy and meaningfulness to their lives. We have to tap into that and help them discover that for themselves at any age. It's never too late.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I live by. I love kung fu movies because one of the things they would always say, your kung fu is strong. But that's basically what we're saying. Kung fu is not just the martial art. Kung fu means the same thing, that you're tapping into your artistry and that whatever that is strong and helps to make you vibrate in the light and bring that to the rest of the world and the hope.
True, but the difference in martial arts, and I've been doing martial arts for a very long time, the art in martial arts is not using it.
Yes. At least not for confrontation anyway. Defense and health.
Yeah.
And clarity. What art do you study?
Ninpo Taijutsu or Ninjutsu.
Okay. All right. I studied Okinawan karate, a little bit of capoeira, and some Wing Chun.
Beautiful forms.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could still do it, but yeah, I love that stuff. Love that stuff.
Hey, I'm sorry. I do have to bounce, but this has been such a tremendous pleasure. I'm so honored to be in your presence and your grace. And I'm just humbled. And I was telling people in the Fort Greene district.
Yes, you know, yes.
I shouted you out and people echoed. Just know you cast a long shadow and you're greatly missed.
Oh, thank you. So great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I appreciate it. And take care of yourself. So it's thank you so much. All right. Have a fantastic day.
You too, lady. Talk to you soon.
All right. Peace. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artists. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tea Time. Thank you for joining us this week on Tia Time with Artist. Make sure to visit our website at tiaviolin.com, where you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. Please leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts to expand the reach of the show. We really appreciate that help. And we'd also like to say thank you so very much to our sponsors, Michigan ArtShare, a program of Michigan State University Extension, and Cold Plunge Records. And also all of our Patreon supporters. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you. We'll see you next week at Tea Time.